of the parts, all of the indispensable parts are present and interacting together, or nothing is going to function right. Today I did a talk for some scientists, and someone showed up with a video projector and they didn't bring the power cord to the video projector. That power cord was essential, and without that cord, nothing was going to happen. It is that kind of important, essential part that is absolutely necessary. And when we're talking about human reproduction, it's really important, because unless all of the parts are there and functioning together, you don't get offspring, and if you don't get offspring, you don't get any evolutionary progress. So it is really essential that all the parts are functioning together for human reproduction. And mechanically, it's the minimum number of parts needed to obtain any type of intended function. Now, what I'm calling all-or-nothing unity, Michael Katz and another researcher named Michael Behe called irreducible complexity back in 1996. But that's a mouthful, and most people don't know what irreducible complexity is. But it's easy to remember when you're talking with your friends. Unless all of the essential parts are there, nothing is going to function properly. So, once we establish all or nothing unity that's a problem as an organ for a system, it is really good evidence against evolution. And as it says there, it is really compelling evidence for creation, because it's hard to build this up in a bit-by-bit method. And that's why Charles Darwin himself, much to his credit, in his seminal work, 1859, on the Origin of Species, he actually put a test to falsify his theory. And he wrote it very concisely, said, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous, successive, slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Now that's the test we all need to keep in mind as I go when I talk about human reproduction here. Everything, and I mean everything, must be explained by, what are they? Numerous, successive, slight modifications, or the theory would absolutely break down. So I'm going to ask you to repeat that again and again throughout the talk. It must be explained by what? Numerous, successive, slight modifications. Now you guys are really at a disadvantage, because they keep pulling the slides off the screen so you can't cheat. So you're going to actually have to remember this. When I'm down in Texas, I keep the words up on the screen, and then they can cheat and they can repeat it all throughout the time. So, numerous successive slight modifications is what is going to happen. So all or nothing unity right at the cellular level. And if we were going to talk about reproduction, we would talk about, of course, the sperm and the egg. And you look up here on the screen over here on the right, you see this giant enlarged sperm. We're going to talk about almost all of the sections of this sperm. We're going to talk about this tail, the motorized midpiece, the head where all of the DNA is contained. We're even going to talk about this little structure called the acrosome. Now, the human sperm is one of the smallest cells in the human body. Very, very, very tiny. And of course, it's going to mate up here with an egg. And over here, we have a freshly ovulated egg. And you notice it's not totally smooth like a hen's egg right here. It is rough. These are cells which are part of the ovary after it was ovulated. And actually, the human egg is the largest cell in the human body, just barely visible to the naked eye. And you can see, by its size here, this egg dwarfs the size of a human sperm that is going to fertilize this egg. We're going to talk about how all of these things fit together. But first is the formation of sperm. And as you see up here on the screen, you see this drawing of how sperm cells begin. They begin as this round stem cell. A stem cell is a cell that constantly divides. It's constantly dividing. And it's a round spheroidal cell. It's immobile. It can't move. It has all kinds of little organelles in it. It's surrounded by a fluid called cytoplasm. And as sperm develop over 60 to 70 days, they grow a long tail. All of the little organelles, particularly these mitochondria, are going to line up as the motor part. All of this extra fluid is going to be shed. And over that period of time, it goes from a cell, which is kind of like a kind of a beached whale kind of a cell, can't do anything, to, at the end, a real lean, mean swimming machine, which is able to actually come up and find an egg and fertilize that. Well, how does all of that happen, and where does all of that take place? Well, all of that takes place in the testicle, behind a structure called the blood testes barrier. Now, I'm sure you've never heard of the blood testes barrier, but it's something that is in the testicle, and it is really, really important. And you'll see over here on this picture, we have a drawing of two cells. These are in the testicle. They're called nurse cells or Sertoli cells. And you'll notice that they have long arms that stick out. These arms join together and they make the barrier. And here is where the stem cells are. And once they divide, they slip through a little lock and they start their little journey forming little sperm cells. Now, why is there a blood testis barrier? Well, as it says there, it protects them from the immune system. So I guess I better give you a little background on the immune system. As you are developing inside your mother's womb, your immune system is educating itself. On all of your cells, there are tiny little markers, and the markers are unique to you and nobody else on this planet. They are totally unique to you. And as you are developing inside your mother's womb, your immune system memorizes the pattern of the markers on all of your cells. And once it memorizes those patterns, it says, this is self. And the immune system has one function: look for anything in your body which is not self and destroy it. And it is really, really good at destroying non-self cells. Well, boys don't start producing sperm until they're about how old? 12, 13 years old. Some of the really precocious guys start producing, you know, sperm in grade school. They already start growing hair on their face and beating up the other kids. But most start producing sperm until they're 12 or 13 years old, when you hear their voice start to change. Well, the markers on the sperm have not been identified as self. So they would be completely destroyed by the boy's own immune system if they were exposed to the immune system. And that is why they develop here behind, back over to the picture here, behind this barrier, right behind the barrier there. And this is what it looks like in real life. This is a sample of real living tissue. It was taken from a testicular biopsy from a man. That's where they took a sharp little hollow needle and they stuck it into the side of the testicle, taking out a little core of tissue that they pulled out and they put on a slide and they stained it pink. Now, if you could see from my perspective of the room, about half of the crowd here has this horrified look on their face as I describe what's actually happening here, there. And I suspect this wasn't the highlight of this guy's day either, but nevertheless, this was really important tissue to look at, because you can see here are the nuclei of those nurse cell. The dark stained portions are the DNA, the chromosomes, and they are being condensed down very, very tight into these little sperm. Can everybody see the sperm there with the little tails? All of this frothy material is the extra cytoplasm, and this is where the blood testes barrier is. You can see a clear demarcation between the light staining pink and the dark staining pink. And this particular biopsy actually clipped right through a blood vessel, and you can see the tiny little blood cells that are right there. And this is what it really looks like, and this is where the sperm are actually developing inside that. And this is what a medical textbook says. Not all of the self-antigens, those are your markers, are exposed to the immune system scrutiny during fetal development. That's where it's educating itself. Consequently, they escape being recognized as self. Similarly, developing sperm cells are shielded from the immune system by the blood testes barrier, because sperm cells are not formed until puberty. Therefore, the immune system is not exposed to their antigens, and it goes on to say, if the testes become inflamed, how could they become inflamed? With a groin injury, or if a little boy gets a disease called mumps. My mom told me when I was a kid, you don't want mumps, you'll go sterile. That scared me to death. What in the world is mumps? And that, well, mumps is a viral infection which causes your glands to swell. Testicles are a gland, they would swell up, the barrier breaks down, and look what happens. Sperm antigens may escape into the circulation. The testes then become a target of the immune response, which causes what? Sterility. Now, sterility is a bad thing. It's a bad thing for evolution. It brings evolution to a screeching halt. Now, evolution has to explain all the things I'm talking about here through numerous successive slight modifications. And here's a picture of the normal tissue, which we just saw. And this is a picture of a biopsy from a man who is sterile. That's a tragic thing. You don't see any sperm in that slide because they have all been destroyed by his own immune system. And in fact, 1 out of 5 couples struggles with some type of infertility issue on that case. And this is what it looks like for a man who is in fact sterile. So this is a real thing. It's a real problem. It would be a real problem for evolution there. Well, not only do these nurse cells protect the sperm from the antigens, they have other functions as well. For instance, they also are able to take all of the extra cytoplasm, which you see surrounding the nucleus of the sperm, and all of this extra cytoplasm, this fluid, is engulfed by these nerve cells, and they recycle it in the development of other sperm. So that's an important function that they do. In addition, as it says there up on the screen, they provide nutritional support. That's because the sperm are living tissue, they need oxygen, they need nutrients, but they're shielded from the blood system, so these cells take it from the blood system and transfer it over to the developing sperm. The third thing it says up there is they concentrate testosterone. Now, testosterone, this is something, if you're taking notes, you need to write down. Testosterone is the world's greatest hormone. So write that down. The world's greatest hormone, testosterone is. Underline it, circle it, put a big box around it. Because testosterone is what makes men look like men. That's important. Testosterone is what makes men like the things men like. Testosterone is what makes men think the way we think. So the bottom line is, you can never get enough testosterone. Testosterone is what makes the world go round. Is that not true? Yes, that is. That's it. So testosterone is actually needed in very, very high concentrations for the sperm to develop, much higher than in normal circulation. So these cells take it out of circulation, they concentrate it, and they bathe the developing sperm in just the right concentration so that they form normally. And then if we go back up to the slide again, the next important function that they do is they secrete anti-Mullerian hormone. Now, what in the world is anti-Mullerian hormone? Well, I'll tell you one thing, it's really an important one, because right after fertilization, as tiny little embryos develop inside of mom's womb, every single one of them will start to develop female reproductive system. 100% of them start down that track. Inside, they start to develop a tiny little uterus, tiny little ovaries, tiny little fallopian tube. And at just the right time, under the influence from the Y chromosome, this hormone, anti-Mullerian substance, is secreted, and it causes that little uterus to regress, the little ovaries to form testicles, and all of the female structures to regress and form male structures. Now that had to develop by what? Numerous successive slight modifications. So if testosterone is like the world's greatest hormone, anti-Mullerian substance, you can say, is the second greatest hormone. Because without it, we would not have any male babies. And of course, that would bring a quick end to evolution too. So these are really important structures that are developing. So we come up with a question, how in the world did sperm ever survive before there was a blood testis barrier? The next question would be this, how did sperm ever develop without those nurse cells? The absence of either one of these things results in sterility, which brings a quick end to any evolutionary development. But this is the kicker, folks. The genetic information to make those structures is carried on the sperm themselves. So how do you get the sperm without these structures, and how do you get these structures without the information of the sperm? I would argue that this is really good evidence which shows fully functional design of which all of the parts had to show up at the right time or nothing would function normal. Second point you need to learn about all or nothing unity is it shows key features of specification. And whoever built this building wrote out a set of plans and specifications. And specifications show signs of intelligence because, as it says up there on the screen, they always select key features in advance with exact attributes for a purpose. And this is always, 100% of the time, always a sign of intelligent behavior. There has never been a time in human history when those features have ever been observed to arise by totally natural processes. Always a sign of intelligent behavior, and natural selection, whatever that is, cannot begin to confer it. So when we find selecting in advance exact attributes for a purpose, we know we are looking at something which has an intelligent source by all human observations. Well, that takes us to the next big thing, which is fertilization. So guys, you're off the hook, you've contributed the sperm, you've done your part. Now when I was in school, I was told that fertilization was just something really, really, really simple. All that had to happen was Sammy's sperm had to meet Elvira egg, and fertilization took place. And it always seemed to work very well with two teenagers at the back of a car. But the reality is, fertilization is really a very complex coordinated sequence of events. And what's cool about fertilization is it becomes the first cell of a new human being which is genetically different, genetically unique from anybody that has ever lived on this planet before you and anybody who will ever live on this planet afterwards. Your genetic identity is unique to you as an individual, and that's what happens when fertilization takes place. So, if you were now to be able to take the skin, lift it back from the female pelvis, look inside, you would see something right here. You would see the uterus. It would be covered by this long, broad ligament, which is like a saran wrap covering, which captures the ovary, captures the uterine tube, otherwise known as a fallopian tube. All of this, and this is a wonderful chalk drawing by a great British anatomist named Gray, and he wrote a famous book called Gray's Anatomy, and that's where the name came from before it was hijacked by a television show. And this is a wonderful, wonderful drawing that you would see, but since I do this talk in Texas, I have to come up with a line drawing so that they will understand what's going on there. And what you really see here is, you see here this ovary, once a month, usually just one egg, matures, it's ovulated, swept into the fallopian tube. Somewhere in here, if sperm are present, it will be fertilized. It'll make its way to the inner lining of the uterus, the endometrium, which is shed once a month, which is surrounded by a muscular layer of the uterus, which is able to push the baby out, called the myometrium. Now, what exactly is going to happen for this to take place? Well, sperm need to make their way to the ovary, into the egg. Well, look what a medical text says about that journey. Although sperm are self-propelling, their journey through the female reproductive tract is a difficult one to say the least. The acidity of the vagina is hostile to sperm, and millions of them leak from the vagina or die almost immediately upon being deposited there. Survivors forge ahead through the cervical mucus and upward through the uterus and uterine tubes. Within the uterus, thousands more sperm are destroyed by resident phagocytic leukocytes. Resident phagocytic leukocytes, otherwise known as mom's white cells of her immune system. Because when a sperm gets inside the uterus, in her body, is it self or non-self? Non-self. And her body will destroy it. Okay, back to the resident phagocytic leukocytes. And it is estimated that only a few thousand, and sometimes fewer than 500 sperm out of the millions in the male ejaculate finally reach the uterine tubes, where the oocyte, or the egg, may be drifting leisurely toward the uterus. You know, this is almost like a story of life as I read this right here. Yvonne, these sperm just fighting, and here's the like boopy-doop-doop-doop with the uterus on that. And that's why it goes on to say, a sperm count of lower than 20 million per milliliter makes impregnation improbable. Wow, a guy's got to crank out 20 million of those per milliliter. Well, how many sperm does the average guy make in a day? The average man makes in a day 200 to 300 million sperm a day is what the average man makes. Some of us a lot more, of course, but the average guy makes 200 to 300 million of these sperm a day. Well, they need to find their way into this uterus and find their way over to an egg. Well, here's a line drawing of a uterus right there. Now, unlike a man's body, if you had a thread or something, you could actually go in the vagina, through the cervix right here, through the uterus, out of uterine tube, and you could touch a woman's liver or some of the organs in her body. Well, bacteria could get in, fungus could get in, but very, very few women ever suffer from an abdominal infection. In fact, it's very, very rare. Why is that? That's because there are a lot of barriers. For instance, the environment inside the vagina is very, very acidic, which kills bacteria almost on contact. In addition, there is a thick mucus plug right here in the opening of the cervical os, which plugs it up, almost like a cork in a barrel right there, keeping anything from going through. On top of that, there is these flushing rhythmic contractions inside the uterus. Now this is kind of cool. The uterus is lined by cells with long finger-like projections, which are constantly pushing things out of the uterus. And the uterus even has little muscular lining underneath it, and the muscles contract in a rhythmic way to constantly push things out of the uterus. So anything trying to make its way has a really hard time. And then throw on top of that the attack cells of the immune system, which destroy any invaders which might make their way into that. So you're probably asking yourself the question, what in the world is a lonely sperm to do? You know, how do they ever make their way up there to find an egg? Well, in addition to the sperm that is made in the man's body, they also make seminal fluids. And the seminal fluids, as we come back up here on this, when they hit the acidic environment there, they neutralize the acid on contact in the vagina. And that neutral environment also empowers the sperm. It actually takes it from a sluggish state to an active state where they can swim through the mucus plug. That's because other seminal fluids take that thick mucus plug and they cause it to turn into a watery substrate. So the sperm can actually swim right through that. Once they get in, seminal fluids make their way inside of the uterus. They cause those rhythmic contractions and those finger-like projections which are pushing things out to reverse direction and pull things inside the uterus. Now think about that. This is something that is coded for the DNA in a man's body, made in a man's body, and it's having its primary effect inside the woman's body. Now Darwinism has to explain that through what? Numerous, successive, slight modifications. That's kind of tough to do. And this is what it really looks like in real life. This is an electron micrograph of the lining of the inside of the uterus. You see it's all rough there. Those are those finger-like projections. You can even see the wave-like structures of the muscles underneath it. Here is a sperm making its way through the uterus. And look right over here. That little cell, that macrophage, is a cell of the female attack system, and it's going to home in on the sperm, and it has a lot of weapons to destroy that sperm. Well, how does a sperm ever evade that? Well, in addition to the other functions that the seminal fluids have, they cause a local immune suppression right inside the uterus. So it reduces the female immune response so the sperm have a chance to make their way in. Now you may say, well, doesn't that leave a woman open to a bacterial infection? Well, it might, except that the seminal fluids also have antibacterial properties. So even though they blunt the immune response, they bring in antibacterial action at the same time. Now all of that had to develop through what? Numerous successive slight modifications. I would say all of this shows pretty good evidence of design. Well, is there anything that is coded for in the female body by her DNA which would have its primary effect on the sperm? Well, of course, the answer is yes, else I wouldn't have asked that question. And that is this blunting of the female immune response there. But on top of that here, we'll go to the next slide, we come back here to the inside of this uterus, and there we find a tiny little sperm trying to make his way up there. And on top of that sperm, right over here, you see a structure called an acrosome. Now, what is an acrosome, and how could something so tiny be so important? Well, inside the acrosome, which is really a sac, is a bunch of enzymes. And the enzymes are very important because they can dissolve tissue. And they're very good at dissolving tissue. Remember when the egg was ovulated, it was surrounded by a bunch of cells that were part of the ovary, the corona radiata. Well, this sperm needs to make its way through those cells, and the enzymes right here in the tip of that sperm are able to dissolve that tissue in order for them to make their way. Well, as the sperm swim through the uterus, secretions that are made inside the uterus capacitate the sperm, which enable them to actually fertilize an egg. Now, what does it mean to capacitate a sperm? Well, this is what a medical text says. As sperm swim through the cervical mucus, uterus, and uterine tubes, they undergo a gradual capacitation for the next few hours, meaning they're making the membrane soft so it can spill its enzymes. This is a pretty elaborate mechanism for preventing the spilling of acrosomal enzymes, but consider the alternative. If sperm had fragile acrosomal membranes, while still within the male reproductive tract, they could rupture prematurely, causing some degree of self-digestion of the male reproductive system. Wow, guys, that could ruin your day, you know? Because you're making 200 to 300 million of these per day, all of them with these digestive enzymes. And if it wasn't for these secretions in the uterus, which would make the membrane less intact, these could rupture prematurely. Now, I wonder how many male reproductive systems had to undergo self-digestion before numerous, successive, slight modifications happened in order to prevent something like this. How many of you have ever heard about this on NOVA, National Geographic, or Discovery? They don't tell you the details, because as soon as you see the details, and as soon as you see the complexity, you start to see the design of everything that is there. Well, here we go. We have the sperm, and it's making its way. Since I have actually a picture here, you have the sperm, and this is a giant, blown up view of the side of the egg. And you see over here, the sperm has this acrosome. It releases the enzymes. Over here are tiny little receptors on the side of the egg. And guess what? The receptors on a human egg will only match the receptor on a human sperm. They are species specific, like a lock and a key, meaning only human sperm can fertilize a human egg. And they must fit together like a lock and a key. And oh, by the way, it's these tiny little receptors which send out a signal to the sperm saying, release your enzymes here. And tiny little microtubules will grow from the inside of the sperm. They will bind to this receptor on the side of the egg. The membrane of the sperm and the egg will fuse together. It doesn't show it here, but tiny little fibers will grow from inside the egg. They will snatch the nucleus of the sperm, which is the DNA, pull it inside the egg. The chromosomes will line up with each other, and fertilization has just taken place. And all of that had to happen through what? Numerous successive slight modifications. Now you want a sperm cell to fertilize an egg. but you only want one sperm cell to fertilize an egg. If the system breaks down and two sperm cells, or three, were to fertilize an egg, it would not develop into a baby, it would develop into a cancer. And it would not develop normally. So you need mechanisms to allow a sperm to fertilize, but only one sperm cell to fertilize. And that's why you'll see on the next picture right here, as the sperm unites with the outside of the egg, right here, as soon as it touches this receptor on the outside of the egg, a signal is sent to every other receptor surrounding the egg, and they all instantly change shape so no other sperm can bind to them. In addition, as soon as it touches the outside of the egg, this is kind of cool, the egg will generate an electrical impulse that it will shoot out around the outside of the egg, and any other sperm still in contact are shocked away from the outside of the egg. As one girl in Idaho said, that zapped them. So it did zap them right there on that. In addition, after the zapping takes place, tiny little granules inside membranes are released just inside the membrane of the egg, which causes it to absorb water and swell up so thick that no additional sperm can fertilize that egg. So you have three of these processes. They actually take place. You know, a little electrical charge I told you about? It happens in 60 milliseconds. 60 milliseconds. That's 1/6 of the time it takes you to blink your eye. And I wonder how many of these mechanisms develop through what? Numerous successive slight modifications. And all of these are absolutely necessary in order for a sperm to fertilize an egg, but only one sperm to fertilize an egg. Well, that's what happens. Fertilization takes place. All or nothing unity has been addressed in secular literature, but it has not been defeated in any of the secular literature. Now, how many of you would like to read something right from the secular literature yourself? Well, this is what we're going to look at here. This is a paper published by the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, a pretty elite group of scientists in the United States of America. Now, take your time, read that paper, and report to me what you find. No, we're not going to do that. We're going to look at just a few things of this paper. They're going to describe how the things I just told you evolved in a step-by-step process. These are direct quotes from the paper. The analysis of protein transport provides a blueprint for the evolution of cellular machinery in general. They go on to say then that we proposed that simple core machines were established. Now, as you're reading a scientific paper, you should immediately stop and you say, what? Simple core machines were what? Established? Well, how are they established? Where did they come from? That's kind of a magical explanation. Additional modules, wait a second here. Where did the additional modules come from? They would have been added to the core machines to enhance their function. They go on to say the pieces were, quote, involved in some other function. They were recruited and acquired a new function. And then they go on to mention that this model agrees with Jacob's proposition of evolution as a, quote, tinkerer building new machines from salvaged parts. Now, this is a quotation right from this paper to explain the origination of everything that I was just describing to you. Another scientific paper picked up on this paper, reported on it, which is called Wired Science, News for Your Neurons, and they said this, quote, the necessary pieces for one particular cellular machine were lying around long ago. Were lying around. It was simply a matter of time before they came together into a more complex entity. Wow, that's the scientific explanation. But then this evolutionist, Michael Gray, really clears it up. He says, quote, you look at cellular machines and you say, why on earth would biology do anything like this? It's too bizarre. But when you think about it in a neutral evolutionary fashion, in which these machineries emerge before there's a need for them, then it makes sense. Wow, this is kind of comical. But what this is the best explanation out there right now in the secular literature to describe the origination of the things that I just described to you. What I'm saying to you is this, brothers and sisters, don't be worried. There isn't something out there, really out there in published peer-reviewed journals, which is going to overturn your faith. It is just not out there at all. In fact, this right here is as good as it gets. We just read the best explanation out there. Well now, in the next 8 minutes or so, I have to pause for a commercial announcement by the Institute for Creation Research. If you want to read more about the things we're talking about, buy that book, Made in His Image, written by a genius. So, there you go. That's all that you need to know. All right. Okay, let's take it from fertilization to a baby. Fertilization to a baby. All that's going to happen right here inside the uterus. Fertilization is taking place. Implantation has happened, hopefully at the top or the side of the uterus there. And the medical literature used to have an old understanding of the baby. It said, in the past, the fetus was envisioned as a, quote, passive passenger of the pregnancy unit. Now, what's a pregnancy unit? A pregnancy unit is mom and baby. In scientific jargon, mom plus baby equals one pregnancy unit. And you see this little picture, this little sonogram, this little baby boy right here. But look what the medical text says. But nothing could be further from the truth. It is important to recognize that whereas the embryo fetus enjoys a position of protection from the external environment that is never to be experienced again, it is the dynamic force in the orchestration of its own destiny. Translated, baby is running the show of pregnancy, not mom. Baby is doing everything. So what are those things? Well, here's a picture of an obvious pregnancy unit up on the screen right there. What in the world is baby doing there? Well, first of all, baby, right after fertilization, little chemicals are going to be released into mom's body, suppressing her immune system inside her uterus. Because a fertilized egg would be recognized as self or non-self in mom's body. Non-self. And she's very, very capable of destroying a single cell. So right from the moment of fertilization, local immune suppression needs to take place inside the uterus and continue for the next 9 months. On top of that, there, we'll push the next slide. Hormones need to be released to maintain this pregnancy. And guess who's going to make the hormones, particularly one called progesterone? Baby and the placenta are going to make these necessary hormones in order to keep the pregnancy going. But on top of that, mom's body needs to recognize that it is pregnant long before she even knows she is pregnant. Long before, a couple weeks later, she says, hey, something's missing here, maybe I'm pregnant. Her body already knows that it's pregnant and it is already making adjustments to that pregnancy. Guess who sends 100% of the signals to mom's body to start the adjustments to know that she's pregnant? Baby and the placenta are sending all of those along. Such as what? Such as increasing her blood supply. Because now she not only has to supply blood for herself, but also to circulate around inside of the placenta. In addition, she's going to lose a bunch of it during delivery. Who sends the signals to mom's body to crank up your blood supply, start making more blood? Baby sends the signals. Baby is controlling that in mom's body. And oh, by the way, once you pump up a lot of additional blood inside the system, the pressure could go sky high. Baby sends signals to mom's body saying, control the pressure at the same time. Mom needs to increase her metabolism for herself and her developing baby. Baby secretes a hormone very, very similar to thyroid hormone, which circulates around inside mom's body, making her hypermetabolic. And that's why women, when they're pregnant, are always hot and they're kicking off the covers instead of putting them on because they're in a hypermetabolic state and baby is driving that hypermetabolic state. In addition, the uterus needs to be primed, ready to push the fully formed baby at term out. Well, it gets primed because there is a huge surge of estrogen inside a mom's body. And when the estrogen concentration goes up, little receptors for another hormone called oxytocin go up. Guess who's making all of the estrogen? Baby is. Baby takes the components from mom's body, they go across the placenta, it's made in the adrenal glands in baby's body, sends it back into mom's body, that goes up, the uterus gets primed and ready for delivery, and baby even starts to release small amounts of oxytocin, and that's why just a few weeks before delivery, mom's uterus becomes irritable, and she starts to get things called Braxton Hicks contractions. On top of that, baby is going to make another important hormone called relaxin. Relaxin allows skin to stretch. It allows ligaments, particularly in the pelvic region, to stretch. And in fact, it allows the skin to stretch enormously so that mom can push something the size of a watermelon out of an opening which normally isn't that large. And guess who is thankful that relaxin is being made? Mom is thankful that relaxin is being made, and baby is doing all of that. And then finally, once baby is born, baby wants something to eat. So throughout the entire pregnancy, baby is releasing another hormone into mom's body called prolactin, prolactation in, which the medical text says causes mom's breasts to reach optimum morphological and physiological maturation. Translated, they get bigger. And baby is the one who is causing all of that to happen so that once baby is born, he can get something to eat. And that's why the medical text says, these are but a few examples to indicate unambiguously that the embryo fetus, that's the baby and placenta, or both, direct the orchestration of the physiological adaptations of pregnancy, the maternal organism, otherwise known as mom, passively responds even at times to her own detriment. And you know, mothers do this for the rest of their life. They constantly sacrifice for that baby. And they're doing this, caring for the baby, long before the baby is even born. Clearly, the fetus infant acts to ensure its own survival. So the bottom line is this: it takes a baby to make a baby. And that's kind of tough to do by numerous successive slight modifications. Numerous successive slight modifications. And so that's why I said at the beginning of this talk, if I do nothing but talk about scientific things that the Lord has made, it should lead you to say, praise the Lord. How many of you feel like saying, praise the Lord? We serve a great and awesome God. And every time I do this talk, a chorus that we sing comes to mind as I think about the things that the Lord has made and put inside that woman. It says of the Lord, you are beautiful beyond description, too marvelous for words, too wonderful for comprehension, like nothing ever seen or heard. Who can match your infinite wisdom? Who can fathom the depths of your love? You are beautiful beyond description, like majesty enthroned above. And I stand in awe of you. Amen?
Amen.
Amen. Well, thank you so much for your time and your attention.